Hello and welcome to the Right to Vulnerable podcast, as truthful as resources permit. My name's Jimmy and I've been stuck inside the house for 3 weeks.
And my name's Chazza and I will always win because I've been in the house for a week longer than Jimmy has. Because I had presenting symptoms. It was a cough. It was a fucking cough. We are the Right to Dishonorable podcast and we're slowly losing our minds. But we also try to come to you as often as we can to talk about politics, social issues, and current events. Oh, what a surprise. This week we will be talking about the coronavirus, COVID-19.
Also known as the Chinese virus, or the Wuhan virus.
No, Jimmy, we had this conversation last time.
I just enjoy bringing it up, I'm afraid. It's just it's childish, isn't it?
It is. I'm glad that you are man enough to admit that.
Yeah, I don't feel the coronavirus needs a great deal of introduction in the introduction section of this podcast. Although things have happened since we last spoke.
There is a fun thing, though. In the gay community, on gay Instagram, we've started calling coronavirus the Rona. Which is quite cute, quirky.
The Rona?
Yeah.
What is that a reference to?
I can't. It just sounds like a woman's name, doesn't it?
Is that it? That's enough for you guys, is it?
Yeah, it is for us guys. Cis straight men, am I right?
Are you right? where to begin? So I think we are going to be discussing some of our personal experiences, which Jazza will love. He likes to make it personal on this podcast. I didn't mean anything by that. It came out that way, but
it came out quite judgmental, actually, Jimmy. I don't appreciate that.
We're all about making judgments on this podcast. Speaking of judgments, we are going to be judging the failed career, I think it's fair to say, of Jeremy Corbyn, or was it? We'll be debating that one way or the other.
Cool. It's going to be a great debate because I think both of us land on a particular side of this. But you did share quite recently today on Twitter, I think, a Medium letter to Jeremy Corbyn, saying how great he was.
Yeah.
I have thoughts about it.
He won the argument, Jazza. If there's one thing that we learnt at the last election, it's that Jeremy Corbyn won the argument. It's pretty much a given now, I think it's fair to say, unless there's a sudden last-minute upset that Keir Starmer, who I think it was his shadow Brexit secretary,
correct.
I think I'm right in saying, will be following him up as the next leader of the Labour Party. Voting has closed, so do not send in your voting slips.
Mm-hmm. I'm very excited for another white man to lead the Labour Party. Shaking stuff up a little bit, you know?
Yeah, we'll be talking about that aspect, I think, among other things. But yeah, this is a short intro and we can go straight into the music and potentially beg you for money. Although it's probably not the best time to be handing over cash for us, I don't think.
Yeah, I feel like we're fine. Give it to a singer or a band that have had to cancel a tour or something, or to a charity that is deserving of it, rather than to us, because we're fine.
I mean, I am actually in a band that has had to cancel a gig, but, you know.
Yeah, but Jimmy, you do have a day job.
I do have a day job. Yeah. If someone has made bad life decisions and tried to make music into a career, then you can give them money in order to encourage them further. I think that's... So we'll skip the begging, although probably should do our thank you section, but then we'll go into the actual full-blown podcast.
Well, okay, don't worry. This intro was originally short, but now it's back to normal length. Excellent. Play the music, Jimmy.
If you like what we do at the Right Dishonorable podcast, you can support us by going to patreon.com/rightdishonorable. It's a pretty conventional Patreon account, and I'm fairly sure most of you know how that works. So if you're interested, head over there and do the business. We'd like to thank our existing patrons, Andrew Kilpatrick, Bent Hugary, David Warner, Gemma Cumming, John O. Matt, and Ollie McGregor. Thank you very much for your support. Jazza, what's your main coping strategy been during your 4 weeks of oppressive seclusion in the wilds of Stratford?
I went through a phase of really relishing my outdoors time, and then I realized that it gave me a shit ton of anxiety, and so I stopped. I've also really enjoyed budgeting for food, because I don't often have to do that, because I have a canteen at work. So that's been quite, that's been a novel thing for me. Wow, my privilege is shining through. I've also been partaking in early evening drinking throughout the week. I found out quite early on that Deliveroo would send somebody to me carrying wine from an off license, and have used that more often than I should have, and to the point where it became financially viable for me to get Deliveroo Plus. And I also have finally started playing an MMORPG. I'm playing Final Fantasy 14 at the moment, and I am a level 21 gladiator named Stella.
Wow. I mean, it sounds like you're having a cracking time.
You know what? It's absolutely completely fine. The only really annoying thing is that I started dating somebody like 2 weeks before lockdown, and was trying to do like the coy thing of like no sex before the third date. And then we weren't allowed to leave our houses, so I'm just sexting a lot. How about you? You're in a stable relationship. How are things going for you?
I mean, my girlfriend probably wouldn't appreciate me divulging too many details of that side of things, but that is fine, I think. It sounds like
Jimmy, stop. You've already said too much.
It sounds like I'm getting more action than you anyway. In terms of the booze situation, we have been ordering... This is... Just to sort of entrench the level of privilege on this podcast, we've been ordering craft beer in crates, which has been setting us back a fair bit. But when you can't go to the pub, you know, you have to divert that budget somewhere else, obviously. You can't just save the money. That would be insane. The main feature of my lockdown, as no doubt podcast listeners will be hearing quite a lot over the coming few weeks, is that my broadband internet went down at the start of this, and we can't get it fixed. So I've been running off mobile data tethering through my phone, which isn't fun. I don't recommend it, but I'm doing but other than that, to be honest, it's a pretty cushy deal.
Have you been spending your time with? Because obviously you're a journalist, so most of your time is just spent in your pants on your bed anyway, isn't it?
I think you'll find I'm a respectable defence journalist who works for an esteemed title.
Yeah, you can still do that in your pants, Jimmy.
You can do, yeah. I've been rolling out of bed, not actually getting into proper clothes until about lunchtime.
Can I tell you something really quite disgusting and embarrassing? I rolled out of bed really, like I slept very badly, woke up at like 9:15 today, felt very bad that I was meant to be, quote unquote, at work. Then put on some exercise gear without getting washed yet because I was like, you know what, I have a half hour where I can do a HIIT workout, and never have, and I'm just sitting here stewing in my own filth in a lycra top. So
you didn't do the workout at the end?
Nope.
Wow.
I started drinking wine, Jimmy, before I did my workout.
I mean, that's not the best order, I would say. But,
it isn't, but you know what, at least it's going to potentially spice things up a little bit.
Yeah. There is something about... I don't know if this says something bad about me, but the temptation to start drinking sort of relatively early in the day when you know you're not going out for the foreseeable future is quite high on my part. And I never normally would. I'm like, I'm one of those people that would save it for the weekend, but just sticking away back to that craft beer.
I think especially when I have writing to do, I think I'm just better drunk. Is that a problem?
Well, I mean, if you're planning on becoming a professional writer, I think that could be dangerous for your health.
No, I don't. I'm very dyslexic and I'm bad at it. But, you know, the bar is low.
So other than playing MMOs and drinking quite early in the day, is that the limit of what you've been doing with your free time?
Yeah, pretty much. Well, what's been quite interesting is kind of like the gravitation around the press conferences that they do. most evenings now at, from like 5 p.m.
Yes.
They've become a staple for our flat, so we'll kind of like congregate around the TV. It's literally the TV. We're not even using like social media or anything like that. And I remember when the Prime Minister did a like it was a formal address at like 8:30 at night, and he like it was a, it was like we turned on the TV to do it, even though we knew it was going to be on YouTube and we knew it was going to be on Twitter and all of those kind of things. We watched it as a group around the television, and I think that that regression to kind of like those communal, like as communal spaces can be at the moment, is quite interesting. There's something comforting about it, I think.
Yeah, I think that is. I mean, I've got to say we haven't been doing the same, but it does sort of feel as though, like, well, I guess we're sort of in the same position where most of the time we're kind of running around doing things, and very kind of rarely in the house on like a stable, regular basis, like every week. Mm-hmm. And it does feel as though that kind of life has reasserted itself. I guess for some people they live like that anyway, so they probably haven't noticed the difference. But
but instead of Boris Johnson standing behind a podium, it's The One Show or something.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, do you find the conferences have been worth watching then? Have they been useful, insightful?
Some of them have, especially at the early seasons were a lot better than what it's turned into now. Like it was used as kind of like the set piece. It felt like, especially in the first couple of weeks, that it was the important point of the day where they were laying out each day there was something different that they were trying to do to counteract the economic difficulties and the I'm not even sure what, like, the medical next steps for their country plan. And that has definitely kind of like dropped off a little bit since, I think, also because a lot of the things that they can announce just aren't coming to fruition as quickly as they want to. There's been a huge amount of criticism actually around, like, initially there was a load of praise for what's his name? Rishi
Sunak. The Chancellor.
Sunak. The Chancellor, there was a lot of praise for his initial plan, but now, a couple of weeks later, it turns out that it isn't nearly as comprehensive or as easy to for companies to sign up to as they previously thought.
So these are all the fiscal handouts and,
yeah,
like,
yeah,
you know, money for workers, like, and that sort of thing.
Apparently the word of the year already is unprecedented, and that amount of money, especially being spent by a Conservative government, was unprecedented, and it proves that something like austerity is made up and you don't need to have it because the economics of a country are not the same as the economics of a household. But anyway, I digress.
I don't think this particular period does prove that. I mean, I agree that austerity was a political choice, and maybe not the best advised one, but the kind of emergency measures we're going through are not sustainable in the long term, I don't think.
I don't think we necessarily know that. Some of the responses actually from commentators, not so much from the Labour Party, because they've been somewhat paralysed and silent because of their leadership contest. Jeremy Corbyn has been busy bringing it to the Prime Minister every single day at the dispatch box. It has been interesting seeing a lot of commentators say that maybe this is going to make the case for a more centralised socialism in our country. It was quite rightly pointed out that a lot of the kind of plans for given to people who are losing their jobs because of lack of work, because of the outbreak, are actually just being put on benefits packages that are very common across the whole of across the rest of Europe. So people having a certain percentage of their pay for a certain number of months after they are laid off, for example, are quite common across places like Germany, Netherlands, Switzerland, etc. And there's kind of like this pontification that this is going to turn into, like, we're going to end up with a universal basic income, and this is going to make the case for, I don't know, like rationed time outside or something, I don't know, and an appetite for that in the wider population. But frankly, I don't see that happening, because we see the Second World War, where there was rationing for a period of time after the war, but there was absolutely no appetite for it. And there was a lot of talk back then of the Labour Party wanting to bring in rationing forever.
Really?
Yeah. They were like, the NHS was just one side of things. They wanted to continue rationing indefinitely. And well, a lot of Labour people from the time, at the very least.
That is quite interesting. I mean, I think the, I haven't really looked at the numbers of this, but the debt, the kind of debt that's actually going to accrue from these measures does seem, I mean, it's just intuitively, it sounds as though it's going to add up quite quickly, basically, if we keep going for as long as 6 months, which has been one time period that has been suggested for these kind of measures. I sort of agree with you, though. Well, I don't know if you were saying this exactly, but I agree with the view that some of these measures probably will survive beyond the coronavirus period, because I think that they'll unwrap some of them once they're no longer needed, but some of them will prove popular or useful in other ways. Like, I think it's any kind of period of like radical change in terms of, I mean, a lot of this stuff is basically welfare, it could end up with some of it sticking, but it's not, I think a lot of people are being quite premature with predicting which bits will stick and which bits won't at this stage.
Oh, well, I was about to ask you, what do you think are the most likely ones to stick and which ones aren't?
God, I really don't know at this stage. I mean, the thing you outlined around people having like a percentage of their pay after they get laid off, I think is quite attractive, like as a measure. Although I guess the criticism of that is that in some ways it's not the most progressive welfare thing you could have, because it helps people who have been able to get jobs in the first place. So you know, there's arguments against that, I suppose. I suppose, you know, in some ways I am more sympathetic to the idea of a universal basic income, I reckon, than the average person, because I don't share necessarily the intuition that people should have to work for their salary necessarily. How affordable that is, I don't know.
We don't really know for something as big as universal basic income, right? I would be surprised if something like those, something akin to kind of like the Swiss system, for example, where you get 80% of your salary, I think it's 80 or 70% of your salary up to a year after you are laid off, and then it gradually goes down year by year by year. I would be really surprised if something like that lived on. What I think will be the most likely things to live on from this era will be accessibility and speed at which people are able to access benefits. Because there's clearly been a big hole blown in the middle of these, where people have just lost their jobs, have been told to sign up on benefits, and it takes however many weeks for them to actually end up seeing the first of that cash. And that just isn't sufficient for many people who, even when they were in employment, are living hand to mouth anyway. And that's not anything of their fault. That's because the cost of living is high, and because wages are still pretty low.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of funny that I sort of joked earlier about Jeremy Corbyn, quote, winning the argument, and there have been some people who've said that, oh, look, it only took like a pandemic for the Tories to accept like the general principles that Labour, that, you know, allegedly Jeremy Corbyn was trying to promote in his leadership. But I don't think a lot of this will sustain, and I don't think... I think Britain, when you compare it to most of Europe, just doesn't really buy into welfare as a concept as much as the rest of Europe does. I think that I don't really sense that there's in as much appetite for things like that Swiss benefit you just outlined.
Shirkers and what are they called? Shirkers and like
Strivers?
Strivers and Skivers and...
Oh, I don't know.
That was a George Osborne thing.
Yeah, we're just more, not in a positive way, I don't think, but we're just more American in our attitudes to... We sort of have that thing around work, and, you know, you shouldn't really be able to get something for nothing.
This was also this was actually something else that I wanted to pick your brain on a little bit, from kind of like the change in attitudes and the attitudes that we're seeing kind of played out in this. So many people are calling it a new normal, and it is, and it's weird to kind of like say that. But another way that I think that we are kind of echoing the American archetype is kind of like this pushback from the policing of the police. So there's been a lot of constabularies that have decided to take a much harsher stance, because all of our policing is decentralized into localities, be it the Met in London or kind of like more rural places. They have taken it into their own hands to kind of enforce these restrictions on physical distancing that have come from the government, Boris Johnson. Some of them have been criticized for being overly harsh. What is your kind of like, have you seen any of this on especially Twitter? Actually, I see a lot of like the libertarians and especially the Brexit lot, their big gripe at the moment is their right to drive to a nice part of the Cotswolds and walk is now being encroached on. But anyway, what has kind of been your interpretation of the behaviour of the police?
So, I mean, I probably am more on the side of the libertarians, as you put it, I think, than you are, by the sounds of it.
You know me, I just like to be cruel.
I think for listeners who haven't come across this, probably the most prominent case of this was the Derbyshire police, who sent a drone over, I think it was somewhere in the Peak District. My UK geography is failing me now, but because they saw some people who'd driven out to what they call a beauty spot, but which is really just a huge park, really, to walk their dogs. And apparently this is bad for some reason. Even though as a form of social distances, it seems much more effective than just taking a walk down, you know, around your local area if you live in the suburbs, which is what I've been doing. Go on.
Well, like for specifically the Derbyshire thing, there was something very sinister about that video. If you've seen it, it is kind of like do not drive to a place in order to partake in a walk, not socially distancing more than 2 meters, and there's kind of like these really quite fancy graphics of real individuals kind of being judged by this. I understand kind of like the, and I have questioned the desire to stop people from driving to kind of like the national parks and stuff like that. But I did hear quite a good explanation from a member of the Derbyshire Police on the Today program a few days ago, where they were saying that they should if somewhere like the Peak District is a place where it is likely that somebody is going to injure themselves and need rescuing, for example, and then that puts those people into like the rescuers, it puts them in jeopardy as well.
I wouldn't say it's likely, it is possible.
Yeah. But it's likely more than kind of going to your local park in London, for example.
That is true.
Like it's
because
of the remoteness. And that was kind of like given as a reason why. And also,
that's fine as a piece of reasoning, but I think the reason there was such backlash against it, and this was outlined by Lord Sumption again, who's a former Supreme Court judge again on the Today program, I think it was. It's not the police's job to make those sort of judgments. I mean, it is fine as a piece of reasoning, but the government guidance said nothing about whether you should drive, whether you can drive to, you know, parks far away, you know, more remote locations. It said nothing about that, and it's not really the police's job to make those sorts of judgments. What slightly confused the issue is that afterwards the government did, so that was in the government regulations, I should say, so that was something that was actually written down and is issued as a kind of piece of legislation. But what some government ministers said was that people shouldn't do that, but that's legally, that is quite different. That's quite mm-hmm. distinct. So, yeah, I think that, you know, the Derbyshire thing, although I do take the reasoning about the, you know, people potentially injuring themselves and needing some form of remote rescue service. And I do think that's fair enough. But at the same time, it's not actually illegal, and the police shouldn't be shaming people and posting drone videos. That was totally inappropriate. And I think the, I think police services in general should not have access to social media accounts, because it seems to do them no good whatsoever, and they repeatedly embarrass themselves over various things.
Antisocial behaviour is stuff that isn't necessarily illegal, but is something that is under the remit of local police. I think that like the way that you talk about it as well kind of highlights some of the confusion that has been around the communication from Number 10 and the central government, where it just hasn't, quite a lot of the information and advice and orders, some of them have been really unclear, and that has been left to open to interpretation by local constabularies, by local police forces, and so you end up with kind of like this broad way of interpreting. And if there were actually some desire and leadership from for example the Home Office, who is technically the boss of all they're the boss of all of the police across the country, then they'd be able to enforce that. But there's been really no, I've seen no kind of like formal response from the Home Office, for example. And actually, really interestingly, I've seen nothing of Priti Patel during this whole event, which I find like it's conspicuous by her absence, I think. And the people that have been wheeled out has been Rishi Sunak, Boris Johnson, Matt Hancock, the health secretary, obviously, and then a load of kind of like the community minister, who I had never seen on television before, a couple of people who are like minor business secretaries and stuff like that, who I just find the selection of the people who have been chosen to represent the government, I'm just like, who's this person? Who's this bloke? They're all blokes.
Yeah, do you see anything in the thing that some people have complained that the spokespeople, particularly the ones that have replaced Boris Johnson while he's been in self-isolation, have all been men? Do you think that is bad?
I think it shows a problem in the people that he's decided to kind of like put in his cabinet. I do find it, like, this is more of kind of like a gossipy side of me, to be honest, and I know you are shocked that I have a gossipy side, I find it so interesting that Priti Patel has been asked to be in, has represented the government at not a single point. As the Home Secretary, especially with all of these increased powers to police, she really should be up there with the Business Secretary, with the Chancellor, as kind of like a spokesperson for the government, and she isn't.
Yeah, I don't know what that is all about, to be honest with you, but I haven't heard, I don't think I've been following it as closely as you have, but I've heard Matt Hancock, the health secretary, you know, giving statements, which obviously makes total sense.
Yeah.
Dominic Raab, the foreign secretary, stood in for Johnson at some point, which I guess kind of makes sense, although...
Yeah, kind of. It's probably the of the big kind of like state jobs. What are they called?
The Great Offices of State.
Yeah, of the four Great Offices of State, it's probably the least... Relevant?
I would say so, yeah. I'd say, yeah. I mean, anything to do with police, as you say, is ultimately Priti Patel's remit. So it's...
And, like, closing borders and having kind of, like, community restrictions. And they've gone with, like, the Housing and Community Secretary for those announcements, which I just found really odd. And maybe it's kind of, like, a realisation that Priti Patel is nothing but kind of, like, an evil lady who... can't manage people, and she, I don't know, I'll stop being nasty, but I think she particularly is conspicuous by her absence, especially as it is her department that is probably one of the most affected, apart from Matt Hancock's, by this crisis.
Yeah, massively so, I would say. I don't know, among people like us that take an interest, she does have a bit of a reputation as a psychopath, I think, particularly for I mean, that's fair.
Oh, I'm glad. I'm glad you said that. She apparently deliberately she makes people sit down and then stands so that she's taller than them. And she's like 5'2".
There's just so many stories. I mean, obviously, some, you know, you can't believe everything you hear, but stories about her bad behaviour, including in jobs before she became a politician. There was something going around Twitter a while back. I probably shouldn't repeat this, but I'm going to anyway.
Oh, excellent. Love a potential libel case for us.
Allegedly, she was working for some sort of PR or comms firm, and one of the clients asked for her to be taken off their account because they just didn't want to deal with her as a person. Which, given what you've heard about her more recently, does kind of tally, although, as I say, this is Twitter hearsay, really.
There was an interesting interpretation of her behaviour by Stephen Bush. I think it was Stephen Bush from The New Statesman, where he said or suggested that actually her behaviour is less kind of like the behaviour of a sociopath or a psychopath, but is kind of also it's also kind of like the type of behaviour of people who are just incapable of proper management and leadership, and so she turns to stuff like belittling people, bullying people, undermining people as a way to be able to show authority. And when you put it kind of like that, it makes me feel a little bit more sorry for her. Maybe she just needs a hug.
Speaking of people who might need a hug, Jazza, in these trying times.
Oh, look at that segue.
Jeremy Corbyn is recording this. Is it the 2nd or the 3rd? I've lost track of the days. It's the 3rd of April. So I think this is either his last day or second.
This
last.
Is his last is day. His last this day. Is his last day, yeah.
Okay. And how long has it been? It's been almost five years.
Feels like a decade. Am I right?
I think did we restart this podcast shortly after he was, or was it while he was picked? I can't remember. It's so long ago.
It was during his leadership election, I think, actually, in 2015 is when we had the Right Dishonourable reboot.
Reboots, yes. There's been I want to say a range of interpretations. I think it's been largely two-sided, really. There's been most people, at least in the comment side of things, think that he's been a massive flop. Obviously, main piece of evidence being the December 2019 election result. Mm-hmm. But some people have said that, you know, he has changed the Labour Party for better or worse. He has, you know, totally overhauled what it means to be a member of the Labour Party, or for, you know, what Labour campaigns for. What do you make of that more positive spin on his leadership?
I think actually we saw a lot of the sustainable outreach and engagement with newer members of the Labour Party and kind of like student activists and stuff in Miliband's era. And actually it was Jeremy Corbyn that kind of like, I think that leadership election in 2015 was a particularly stale one. Apart from him, everybody kind of looked the same. Everybody was either a Brownite or a Blairite. And Jeremy Corbyn was just anything different. Spoke so refreshingly and honestly, he did, especially then, back in those days. And he really, because of the reforms from Ed Miliband's tenure on making it easier for people to be able to have a voting rights within the Labour Party, he brought in an awful lot of people. And I believe the Labour Party is still the largest political party by members in the whole of Europe, which really is something to commend, especially when we have really small numbers for something like the Conservative Party, which still manages to win. I think he has done really... He's opened the gates to a kind of like... I don't think they're necessarily progressive, but...
Socialistic, maybe?
Yeah, like a more socialist, a politically engaged part of our politics that I think it's healthy to have in the conversation. And I think it is going to be healthy to have them back at the fringes of that conversation. But I'm glad that they were here and that they will continue to be here. But I don't think that that kind of ferocity is going to continue to the same degree under someone like Keir Starmer. And I'm quite happy about that. I would rather a Labour Party that is able to win elections and then maybe not be quite as progressive than a Labour Party that continues to lose elections and allow for there to be a very regressive Conservative Party in power.
See, I think the thing you said about membership figures is interesting. I'm trying to remember what the membership count is. It's something like 400,000 or 500,000 members.
I think it went over 500,000 at some point, but I don't think it's there anymore.
Yeah. It has fluctuated around that level since Jeremy Corbyn became leader, I think. But you have a situation here where you have a mass membership party that can't win elections, which seems to summarise Labour's predicament, really. Obviously, all political parties are, they are factional in the sense that they represent different types of like politics throughout the country. No party can represent the whole country. That's kind of a myth, really. But in that sense, Jeremy Corbyn has succeeded in making Labour more representative of a particular type of voter. And in that sense, I guess he can claim success. I mean, that would be a good result, I think, in a more proportional voting system. But it's not a good result to have something that is so lopsided in that way in a majoritarian voting system, which is the sort of system we have. You sort of referenced this, I think when we were talking earlier, this Medium post that I was reading, kind of praising Jeremy Corbyn to the rafters, saying that he has changed the party for the better, I guess because he tilted it more in the direction of the author's politics. But it then said, like, there's expert and popular consensus behind Jeremy Corbyn's policies. And you do hear this line again and again, that people like the sorts of policies that the Labour Party put forward in the December 2019 election.
I think it's really, like, there was something quite mockable and ironic. Not ironic, just a bit. It's probably a little bit pathetic about the fact that when Boris Johnson came into power, people were spinning that Jeremy Corbyn had seen off two Conservative prime ministers. And there's a certain amount of truth to that, but that's because he had such a hold on that membership and he clearly has such an appeal. And you are right to say that he was able to steer a party into like a really popular election manifesto.
The individual policies were popular, but taken collectively, they were not popular.
Yeah, taken collectively with him, they were not very popular. And I hope that Labour doesn't lose that zeal for being like an actual alternative to the Conservatives. And actually, I think there is such a lot of clear water between the Conservatives and Labour now anyway. I think that is good for our politics rather than kind of like the mishmash of everybody being really close and being pro-austerity and kind of agreeing on public spending.
Yeah, I agree with that.
That existed for the first probably 15 years of this century, to be honest. And I think that difference is something that should be maintained. I worry about the media landscape that has now been opened up with him or by those who supported him. And I worry about how kind of like the voices that have definitely seen more prevalence around Jeremy Corbyn's leadership, how they are going to react to perhaps a more moderate Labour Party led by almost inevitably Keir Starmer.
Are you subtweeting in verbal form Navarra Media here?
Maybe.
I mean, it does feel like a good time to pivot towards Keir Starmer. I was reading a profile of him in the New Statesman, actually. And it did depict him.
They did some really, really good profiles of the Labour candidates, by the way. Read all of them.
I think I've only read Keir Starmer's so far, but they were depicting him as being actually much more left-wing than you'd necessarily think and much more in line with Jeremy Corbyn's broad worldview.
Yeah.
I suppose, I mean, it seems that though that's true in terms of domestic policy, and, you know, Keir Starmer, I think, can claim to be a genuine socialist. I don't think that's crazy, but I mean, I don't know where he stands on more like kind of conventional foreign policy questions and that sort of thing, because in the kind of post-war Labour tradition, you did have people who were very in favour of the welfare state and all of that sort of thing, but they certainly didn't have as anti-Western a view of foreign policy as Jeremy Corbyn did.
But I actually think that is going to be such a good thing for Keir Starmer. He has been voted into power with nobody really knowing what he intends to do with it. And that gives you a huge amount of flexibility, especially in the run-up to the next election, which is at least 4 years away. Probably, anyway. That gives him flexibility to be able to mould into whatever is going to be the best counter to what Boris Johnson's government is going to be. And I think that is only a good thing, actually, for them.
I think that's right. I mean, it's in the dynamic of him becoming leader during this coronavirus pandemic is quite interesting, because the early impressions people have of candidates often solidify quite quickly, I think. Mm-hmm. He has like the biggest profile of any of the Labour leadership candidates, the other two being at this stage Rebecca Long-Bailey and Lisa Nandy. But I don't get the impression he's that well known, actually. I think he probably, just in purely superficial terms, gives off a slightly more Blairite impression, certainly, than Jeremy Corbyn, purely because...
He's got a big chin, isn't it?
Well, it's because he, you know, bothers to actually style his hair in the morning, and he wears a suit that actually fits. Mm-hmm. Which, I mean, it, you know, sounds pretty minor, but I feel that even after Corbyn did smarten himself up after a bit, he never really lost that impression of just being a bit of a duffer, really, who rode around on his bicycle and went to sing the national anthem and that sort of thing. And I think Keir Starmer has the opportunity not to make similar mistakes early on in his leadership, assuming he is elected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with you.
So...
But we'll talk about... We'll talk... Keir Starmer gets crowned tomorrow. And the next episode will inevitably talk about him and maybe even his shadow cabinet, if he has chosen it. And won't that be a lovely distraction from all of the shit hitting the fan around the world?
Very much so. Do you think, I mean, just as we wrap this up, do you think it is particularly bad? This is the same question I asked for a previous topic, but do you think it's particularly bad that Labour has also failed to elect a female leader again?
Yeah, it's embarrassing, isn't it? If you look at the diversity at the top of the Conservative Party at the moment, they've got Home Secretary who is a woman of colour. They've got a British Indian Chancellor, a sex pest Prime Minister, and a Foreign Secretary who looks like a Pokemon.
Diversity thing.
I think so. Diversity in all its forms.
The funny thing is, though, I feel that progressives who care about diversity don't really give the Tories any credit for having, as you just listed there, a pretty diverse cabinet as it goes.
Yeah, at the top it is, like the figureheads are. The rest of it isn't actually that great. And you see that from the people who are stepping in for the Prime Minister at these press conferences,
right,
as well.
Yeah, but I was going to say that I think this is the issue of like Labour not having a female leader is something that vexes the commentariat or sections of it anyway. I don't necessarily know that the general public gives a shit, mm-hmm. to be honest. So I'm sure.
Yeah, perhaps, but I think it probably says something about those two parties, actually. And I think you will possibly seeing a mirror of what is happening in the United States, where people vote for somebody, they have a lesser opinion of everybody else in the electorate, and they vote for a man because they don't think that anybody else is going to vote for a woman. And that's one of the theories put forward to why women didn't do better in the Democratic primaries in the United States. And I think that is possibly one of the reasons why women did not so well in the leadership election for the Labour Party.
See, to me, intuitively, if you care about this sort of thing, you probably would vote for a woman anyway. And you know, no offense to the Labour membership, but they haven't shown themselves to be overly concerned about electability in some of their previous choices of leader. I think it's fair to say. And if you, I mean, if you don't care, I suppose you would just vote for whichever candidate you preferred, really. So I see the theory, but it doesn't necessarily stack up for me. But I'm sure we can, you know, leave all of that kind of discussion around Labour's future to the next
episode. It's going to be so exciting.
Yeah, indeed. Mm-hmm. We won't promise.
Oh,
to
we
do...
should probably also just quickly mention the Lib Dems suspended their leadership campaign. So the deputy leader, who's the interim leader at the moment, Ed Davey, is inevitably going to be leader longer than Jo Swinson, whom he lost to in the last leadership election.
Isn't it funny how things turn out?
Isn't it funny how things turn out? But yeah, shall we wrap up?
We shall wrap up. And good. We'll probably be speaking to you relatively soon, but not too soon. We are, you know, we are us, and we don't produce episodes every week.
Why am schedules and who are they?
Exactly. I mean, if this you know, lock-in has proved anything, it's that we can't even organise a weekly podcast, even when we have literally nothing else to do.
I told you, I am levelling up as a gladiator. I'm already at 21 and I need to get to 35 so that I can switch to a paladin, okay?
Okay.
Good. Excellent. You can find us on the internet at JazzaJohn is me on Twitter, and Jimmy is at JDE Nichols. And you can talk to the podcast at Right Dishonor.
Cool.
Yeah, that was it. Okay, cool. Excellent. Goodbye, toodaloo.
Bye-bye.